Gan founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai, and after Koti Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai, Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai, Prem Shikho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Gangamaya Jumuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaura Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Vadaya Vishnu Stabilation of Devakra Swami Tani. Namaste Swami Swami Vivani Tani. So it's February 24th, 2014 in Ljubljana, Slovenia. And we're going to be... discussing Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 6, and also parts from Chapter 12. All right, so messing with this. All right, good? Good, good, good. So we're going to look at how Advaita Acharya is the cause of creation. So Advaita Acharya is the direct incarnation of Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu, or Karuna Dakasha Vishnu, Karuna means cause. So he's lying down in the causal ocean, and he's breathing out all of the universes. Yakara Narna Vajale Bhajatisma Yoga Nitra Mananta Jagadanda Saroma Kupad Hara Shakti Mavalambya Param Swamurtim. Param Swamurtim, the huge form of the Lord. So, of course, people may say, well, this is a fantastic story, right? That some four-armed, humongous... I mean, how big must he be if he's breathing out the universes, huh? Some four-armed, blue, humongous god is breathing out all the universes. How can we believe this? Of course, the scientists also give us a very unbelievable story, huh? They tell us that there was nothing, and then there was this infinitely small, infinitely dense chunk. That's pretty unbelievable. And then somehow it exploded. That's also pretty unbelievable. And then somehow when it exploded, it made all the perfectly orbiting planets and stars that don't crash into each other. That's pretty unbelievable. And then it created this planet with water and air, and then there was some chemical soup, and somehow there was an electric storm, and one of the cells, molecules woke up and became alive. That's pretty unbelievable, considering the scientists have not been able to make one grain of rice in their laboratories. And then this one cell, as it divided and divided, it turned into gorillas and oak trees and giraffes and people. So that's also pretty unbelievable. So I think it's a lot more believable that a person created everything. Whenever you go to origins, you come to something unbelievable. So Advaita Acharya is the same Mahavishnu that in the causal ocean is sleep, breathes out the universe. So he glances over material nature and creates the material world. So here we see Garbhadakshaya Vishnu within each universe, and Brahma coming out of his navel. So this is Advaita Acharya, who's the cause of the material world. So he both breathes out the universes, and he maintains also all the universes. So he is our origin. We were talking about Nityananda is our shelter. So Advaita Acharya also, he's the shelter of the living entities. He's the cause of the material world. Whatever whatever we have, whatever we desire, it's all coming from Advaita Acharya. And of course, we know that all the incarnations in the universe, they come through Mahavishnu. So Mahavishnu also, not only is he the cause of the universe, but he's also the teacher of bhakti. Because the mystery of the material creation is it exists for two seemingly opposite purposes. One purpose is to facilitate the foolish material desires of the living entity, and the other purpose is to purify us of these foolish material desires and take us back to home, back to Godhead. So this is is that? Huh? That's a kirtan. That's a very strange kirtan. That's a real Kali Yuga kirtan. It's like the... That reminds me... That's a kirtan. That reminds me of when I was at the Woodstock Festival. We were at the Woodstock Festival and Dudumna Swami and his crew, 300 devotees. And we take a little Rathayatra cart around the festival grounds. So as we were going, there was this group of young people, and they were dressed all in black with strange makeup on their faces. And they were playing this music that, I mean, I don't know what else to call it. They were playing some sounds over their system, and the sounds sounded like growling wolves with machines in the background. This is the kind of music they listen to in hell. Hell music. C.S. Lewis, he says, the demons, they just want noise. They abhor music and they abhor silence. They only want noise. All right, so Advaita Acharya, as the creator of the material world, he not only wants to facilitate our material desires, but he wants to purify our material desires. It's something like when you're a parent and you have children, you give them toys for playing with the idea that at a certain time they'll give them up. If your children are still playing with toys when they're 35 years old, that's a problem. At the same time, you give them toys. You give them toys. I don't know what you call it in this country. You know, the little thing you stick in a baby's mouth for them to suck on?
Duda.
What do you call it?
Duda.
We call it a duda, huh? We call it a pacifier. Like peace makes them peaceful. They suck on the thing, right? So you may give this to your baby when they're small, but my daughter-in-law, she says, well, I don't like to give this to my babies because I'm afraid when they're 2 years old, they'll still be sucking on this. So, you know, you give it to them when they're little, but then you also want to, at a certain point, take it away. I was somehow in Mexico or Brazil, I forget where. I saw lots of older children with these doodads in their mouth, you know, 4, 5, 6 years old, they're still having these things in their mouth. So the Lord, he facilitates our material desires, but he doesn't want us to hold on to these eternally. So both of them are there. So therefore, Advaita Acharya is a teacher of bhakti. And although he creates the universes because of our material desires, so he also descends to introduce the path of bhakti. And I really would like to have here, when I made this show, I had a very poor internet connection. I couldn't get a lot of pictures. But I was thinking I'd really like to have on this slide one picture for each of the 9 processes of bhakti. So I only have 3 there. But, comes to introduce all the angas of bhakti. And of course, specifically he does this by praying to the Shalagram Shila and begging Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you please come and teach Vraj Bhakti. And you please come with your Sankirtan movement. Now, what is the essence of bhakti that Advaita Acharya has come to teach? So this is quite interesting. We have that Mahaprabhu, he heard the prayers of Advaita Acharya, and he said, okay, what would you like? So what do you think Advaita Acharya asked for from Mahaprabhu? What do you think he asked for? Well, this, he's already come. See, he's already there. You see? See, there he's already there. So in the previous slide,
preparation,
In the previous slide, he was asking for him to come, okay? So now he's up. Oops. Oh, now gave it away. Look at that. Ah, the computer gave it away. Yeah. So he says, please give bhakti to everyone. Please give bhakti to everyone, even Urmila Devi Dasi. Everybody, the women, the low-class people, the laborers, everyone. Now, Advaitacharya appears before Lord Chaitanya, and he appears as Lord Chaitanya Sr. So Mahaprabhu is offering Advaitacharya respect. But Advaitacharya is preaching, what is the essence of bhakti? What is the essence of bhakti? So the essence of bhakti is shown in Advaitacharya's mood, that he's teaching us we are all servants of the Lord. You say to engage in the Sankirtan movement, but with what mood? Like Prabhupada would say, chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, we're saying, please, Lord, engage me in your service. Please, Lord, engage me in your service. So Advaitacharya, although he's a senior to Mahaprabhu, he's thinking, I want to serve. I want to serve. And this is an ocean of bliss. Of course, Mahaprabhu is also in this mood of service. Sorry that the right side of the slide is cut off a little bit. That's an N. It says ocean. It doesn't say oshir. Sorry about that. So, even Mahaprabhu, he wants to be a servant. How ironic that we living entities, we come to this material world because we don't want to be a servant. We come to this material world because we want to be the master. We want to be the Purusha. But the Purusha wants to be the servant. How interesting. So Krishna himself wants to take this mood of a servant. Advaitacharya wants to take this mood of a servant. Because being the servant is so relishable. And we are so foolish, thinking, oh, it's not, I don't want to be a servant. Of course, you know, in the material world, being a servant is not very nice. I haven't yet met the parent who says to their children, please grow up and be a servant. You know, please grow up. When you grow up, I want you to be a butler. I want you to be a maid. I want you to be a janitor. Even if the parent is a janitor, they don't say to their child, I want you to grow up and be a janitor. You all know what a janitor is? Yeah, someone who cleans the... Yes? So I was recently reading a book about leadership and management. That's one of my fields, so I read books in that field. And it was talking about a company that it was a janitorial company where their employees all went and cleaned buildings. But they had problem keeping their employees. And they were saying one reason is that people didn't see a future in that kind of work. You know, you're just cleaning toilets your whole life. They wanted to have some sort of future. So it was a very interesting book about how they made the employees so happy that the company was growing because the employees were very happy. But generally, people don't want to be a servant. They don't want to just be a cleaner. In our modern society, we've eliminated almost all of our servants. Now we have mechanical servants. Right? We have a machine that washes our clothes. We have a machine that washes our dishes. A machine that cleans our floors. Even now they have little robots that you just put in the middle of the floor, seriously, and you just turn it on and it cleans your whole floor. It goes around the room, goes back and forth, or you sit there reading your newspaper or whatever, and it cleans your room for you. I was visiting some devotees in Bloemfontein, South Africa. They have a swimming pool, and when I went out there, and they had it was a vacuum cleaner in the pool, and it's automatic. It automatically vacuums the pool. You know, no humans have to be there. But really, being a servant of the Lord is the most pleasurable thing. We have it backwards. The banyan tree is upside down. And really being not only a servant, but a servant of the servant of the servant. So Advaita Acharya says this. He says, I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya. I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya. I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, and I am a servant of his servants. And this mood, you may be thinking, wait a minute, I remember the other day you were saying how Lord Nityananda was the source of all the Purusha avatars, etc. That's a fact. So here Krishna Das Kaviraj is telling us that the origin of this mood of service is indeed Lord Balaram. And all the other Vishnu Tattva are expansions of Lord Balaram, and they're in that ecstasy. And if we think about Lord Balaram, he's always happy, isn't he? Yes? And this is his mood of service. So all Vishnu Tattva have this mood, and even Krishna, Deepartya Evati Dasantaramabhupecha, Deepayateva Ritahetu Samanadama, Yastadra Gavihita Vishnu Chayabhati. Even Krishna, from whom all the other avatars come. Please don't think that means chronologically. Please don't think first there was Krishna and there was nobody else and then there was Balaram. They all exist simultaneously, eternally. But even Krishna takes the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and is in this mood of service. So what's particularly interesting is that Advaitacharya, being Sadashiva, he is the lord of the ego, of the living entities. Sadashiva represents the false ego. But he is telling us how to get rid of this false ego by thinking ourselves as servants of Lord Chaitanya. So this is in Bengali. So in Bengali, it's not Muni, it's Mui. He pronounces this as Mui. So we can chant this verse. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Chaitanya Radasa. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Chaitanya Radasa. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Radasa. Remember, it's not Muni, it's Mui. It's not Sanskrit. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Chaitanya Radasa.
Chaitanya Radasa Mui,
Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Tanra Dasa Radasa. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Chaitanya Radasa. Chaitanya Radasa Mui, Tanra Dasa Radasa. Now, this is a really nice meditation at the beginning of japa or kirtan. So if you find that when chanting Hare Krishna, your mind wanders, if any of us here are struggling with that during chanting our mind wanders, you can notice, what does your mind wander to? And the mind will wander to things related to our material identity. Oh, I have to send this email. My socks are dirty. I have to remember to wash them. Somebody wrote me something nasty and I need to reply. I have this work to do today at 2 o'clock. Oh, I'm worried about my daughter. She's sick. I mean, what are we thinking about? We're thinking about things related to this identity. Therefore, if we let go of this identity, we will automatically let go of the thoughts. If you hold on to this false identity, then you cannot stop the thoughts in relation to that identity. If you let go of the identity, you will automatically let go of the false thoughts. Now, our idea is not simply to let go of our identity like the Buddhists who want to become nothing and have no thoughts. We want to take our real identity. So, of course, as one advances in Krishna consciousness, one has some more specific idea of one's real identity. One will start to understand, I am Krishna's parent, I am Krishna's friend, I am Krishna's lover, like that. I am Krishna's cow, whatever. So one will start to understand one's real identity in some specificity. If one has not yet started to understand one's identity with some specificity, the general identity is that I am a servant. So if we meditate like this before chanting, And whenever, if ever the mind wanders again go back, meditate. Chaitanya Radhasamui, Chaitanya Radhasa, Chaitanya Radhasamui, Tanya Radhasa, Radhasa. I am simply the servant of Lord Chaitanya. And then in that mood, as soon as one chants the Hare Krishna mantra in that mood, then very easily and very quickly Krishna's form and qualities and pastimes will appear in one's mind. So that was Adi Leela chapter 6, and I know we're sort of kind of going in order in the morning, so I hope you'll forgive me that we're going to go now to chapter 12. Because we are. There we go. All right. So here in chapter 12, we're going to be looking at Advaitacharya's followers. So we've looked at Advaitacharya's ontological position in chapter 6. Now we're going to look at his followers. So here we see that the followers of Advaitacharya, at first they had one opinion, and later on they had two different opinions. Now we should make it very clear here that by different opinions, we mean different opinions about Siddhanta. What's really interesting about the fact that God is a person, among a gazillion other very interesting things, one very interesting thing among many, 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 many interesting things, is that when a person becomes realized, their understanding of Krishna will be somewhat different than another person who's realized. Therefore, we find that the Acharyas have different opinions about different aspects of Krishna. Yes? Yes? Sometimes Prabhupada will, in one purport, say, this Acharya says this and this Acharya says that. And sometimes these opinions are such that they appear to be mutually exclusive. Sometimes it seems from our perspective that it's not possible for both of the opinions to be true simultaneously. If you think about it, right, Mother Yasoda wakes up Krishna in the morning, and when she wakes up Krishna, she sees that he's not very clean. So she thinks, oh, the servants that bathed Krishna last night, they did a bad job. They didn't clean him properly. I have to give them some further instruction. But there's also some young gopis in the room, and when they see that Krishna's dirty, they understand he's dirty because he was out dancing all night in the forest. So Krishna's mother and Krishna's lovers, they have a very different opinion about why Krishna's dirty. And those opinions are mutually contradictory. You follow? They can't both be true. So can you say, Mother Yasoda, that she's not liberated? No, but yet she has a different opinion. So different. There is a kind of spiritual subjectivity. In this world, our subjectivity is a source of great conflict. I have one point of view, you have another point of view, and we argue. And we often think, well, if we could all just agree, then we would stop arguing. So we often try to find some objective truth with which we will all agree. And we think in that way we will solve our problems. So here's a little sociology and science for all of you. So there's two modern philosophies, two secular modern philosophies. Now, secular means you explain things without reference to God. One is called positivism, or it's also called modernism. The other is called post-positivism or postmodernism. By the way, postmodernism has nothing to do with time. It's nothing to do with, not talking about historical time. It's a particular perspective. So positivism or modernism states there is objective truth. There is objective truth, and that objective truth can be A, described in exactly the same way by everybody, and B, accessed through the mind and the senses. So Srila Prabhupada, in many places, tears apart this idea of positivism. We agree that there is objective truth. However, we do not agree that this objective truth can be understood through the mind and the senses. And even more interestingly, we do not agree that this objective truth will be described in exactly the same way by everybody. Do we? That is because our idea of objective truth is that objective truth is a person. It's a person. A person is not going to be described exactly the same way by everyone, nor can a person be understood simply with the senses and logic. A person cannot be understood by math and physics and chemistry. A person can be understood more by stories and poetry, not by math and chemistry. Now, even those who propound a positivistic or modernistic view, they say there's many problems with positivism, which we won't go into all of them right now. But the one Prabhupada mentions, you know, everyone's died, but you can't say everybody's going to die because you haven't seen everybody. There might be somebody who hasn't died. That's one of the problems with positivism. Another problem with positivism is that there can be an infinite number of stories or interpretations one can give of the same facts. Another problem is that we don't have objective mind and senses, but our mind and senses are operating through our personal bias and through our cultural bias. There's some others as well. So as a response to the problems with positivism, there's been this other idea of post-positivism or post-modernism. Post-positivism or post-modernism says there is no objective truth. Which is rather funny also, because they say absolutely there's no absolute truth. Which, obviously, they are saying there's an absolute truth. They're saying the absolute truth is that there's no absolute truth. And the post-positivists say everyone has their own truth, and that everyone's truth is as good as everyone else's truth, which of course nobody really believes. Like, at least the positivists, they think if we could just get rid of our biases and so forth, we could find truth. But the post-positivists, they say everyone's truth is as good as every other, but they don't believe that. They don't believe that, you know, Nazism is just as good as any other idea of reality. They don't believe that the serial killer's view of truth is just as good as everybody else's view of truth. So they don't really believe their philosophy. Neither really believe their philosophy. But we agree with a little bit of each of them. We agree that there's an objective absolute truth. And we also agree that everyone's going to have a different understanding of that absolute truth. That means we will have different opinions. Prabhupada wrote a letter to a Atreya Rishi. He said, disagreements are not a sign of impersonalism, but rather they're a sign of personalism. Because as soon as there's persons, there's going to be differences of opinion. But there should not be a difference as far as the process is concerned. Prabhupada also wrote to Ekayani, Gopal Krishna Maharaj's wife when he was a grihastha. And he said, just like you may have a disagreement with your husband, but that doesn't mean you are not both devotees. So we should be very careful to not think that all of us have to have the same exact opinion about everything. When we think that way, we tend to think that my opinion is correct and everybody has to agree with me. That's usually how we interpret without realizing that, of course, because we all think we're gods, so we think my opinion is the same as God's opinion and everybody has to agree with my opinion. We're not even aware that we're interpreting. That's another whole discussion. Hare Krishna. But there shouldn't be any disagreement about the Siddhanta. So the principle is whether or not one is following the order of the spiritual master. Now, even if we say there shouldn't be a disagreement about the Siddhanta, so this is a very intellectual, academic, studying Prabhupada's books temple, so this is a place I feel comfortable to talk about these things. So this is a little tricky, because what is the Siddhanta about which we cannot disagree? Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave us 10 points, Das Mula Tattva. Perhaps you're familiar. And these are points that are true without context. Because even the points Krishna makes in the Shastra, they have a context. Do you understand what I mean by context? Like Krishna says to Arjuna, for one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. And then he also says to Arjuna, be detached from this honor and dishonor. So those two have a different context. How can you be detached from dishonor if you think dishonor is worse than death? Do you all understand what I'm saying? Or like Krishna preaches karma mimamsa philosophy to his father. That's also in the Bhagavatam. It's also spoken by Krishna. So you could take, well, if you take it out of context, there would be so many misunderstandings. So the Das Mula Tattva seems like it's representing truths that are true in all contexts. Truth that has no context. But yet we find, like Ramanujacharya only agrees with, I think, 8 or 9 of the 10 points. And Madhvacharya, in whose line we claim that we are members, only agrees with 7 of the 10. So I find this fascinating. I find this fascinating. And sometimes in our Hare Krishna movement, we have big battles over items of philosophy. Great big battles over items of philosophy. And I've been privy to one of them in the last few days. And people calling each other, you know, well, you're not faithful, you're a rascal, you're a renegade, and so forth. And it really takes some, how would we say, I don't want to claim that I have it, so this is a problem. Anyway, it really takes some maturity and some realization to understand what are points that actually separate us from Lord Chaitanya's tree and what are points that don't. You know, what are the statements of belief, what are the dogma, what are the practices that are absolutely essential in order to be getting the water and be part of Mahaprabhu's tree? And what are the points where when we don't follow them, we become separated from the tree? So I think about Srila Prabhupada talking to Siddha Sarup, who wanted to start his own movement. And Prabhupada said, yes, a tree is beautiful if it has many branches, but make sure that the fruit tastes the same. And we should expect, it's quite interesting also, that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Krishnadas Kaviraj is describing these branches of the Chaitanya tree, Srila Prabhupada is asserting that ISKCON is one of the branches of the Chaitanya tree, yes? Now when Prabhupada wrote that, ISKCON was not accepted by the rest of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, more or less. We were seen as all a bunch of foreigners. And Prabhupada was trying to establish, yes, yes, we're part of the Chaitanya tree, we're part of the Chaitanya tree. When I was 3-4 years old, I would go to school in a bus with kids from ages 3 to 7 or 8. And the big kids would beat up the little kids. They'd have their comic books and they'd roll them and they'd hit us over the head with them. And I would go crying to the principal of the school. On the bus, they're beating me up. And guess what I started to do when I was 7? Then I rolled up my comic books and I was beating the little kids. I don't think I've ever admitted this publicly before, but anyway, I was doing that. So there's a tendency, just like in governments, there'll be, you know, a revolution, and when the revolutionaries come to power, then they beat up everybody else. So when Prabhupada wrote that ISKCON's a branch of the Chaitanya tree, we were the little guys. And like Prabhupada saying, we are a branch, accept us as a branch. So now we're the big branch in the world, yes? There's no other branch in the world comes anywhere close to us. So now we're beating up all the little guys. Oh, you guys aren't really branches. We're the only branch, you know. Hare Krishna. So Krishnadas Kaviraj, Srila Prabhupada never said that ISKCON was the trunk of the tree, folks. Never said. He said we were a branch. And Krishnadas Kaviraj also said that every branch would have hundreds of sub-branches. So sometimes we try to stop our branch from creating sub-branches. But first of all, it's inevitable that our branch will have sub-branches. Krishnadas Kaviraj says so. And also, that's part of the beauty of the tree. So how do you know if a branch is connected to the tree? How do you know if a sub-branch is connected to the branch? How do you know? The fruit has to taste the same. And that's the ultimate test. That's the ultimate test. I mean, it's very interesting. I don't want to say what the discussion is about. But anyway, there's this philosophical discussion. Is it like this or is it like that? And just for the record, I happen to agree with the GBC resolution on this decision. But in any case, there are people who are different, and some of them are also GBC members who don't agree with their own resolution, which is, you know. But I see that the fruit is the same. I mean, I've really come to the conclusion that it doesn't matter. It's when you see the fruit is different, then you start having a real problem. So what's the fruit? What's the fruit? What fruit are we looking for?
Bhakti.
We're looking for bhakti. And Jesus also said this. He said, how do you tell a fig tree it has figs? If you say, I'm a fig tree, but I don't have any figs, then you know what? You're not a fig tree. Or you're not getting any water. You're not getting any fertilizer. And that's how we tell. I mean, Prabhupada told my father in 1974, he said, there's meanings to many religions as long as they're trying to know God and love God. So this is what we see. Are people trying to know God and love God? And I'll give another example. I'm really taking some risk here. It's being recorded and it's on the internet. Hare Krishna. Urmila the fool. All right, so some time ago, one devotee recommended to me, why don't you read this book of St. Teresa of Avila called The Interior Mansions. So I read this book and I thought, my God, she's describing Shraddha to Prema. Actually, she's describing Vikarma to Prema. And she's talking about these mansions within the heart. She spends a long time on the sixth mansion, which certainly appears to be a description of bhava. And she talks about love of God in Madhurya Ras. It seems to be in Swakya rather than Parakya Ras. But she's definitely describing Madhurya Ras. There's just no question about it at all. There's no ambiguity about it. And she was very good friends with St. John of the Cross, who also very actively propagated Madhurya Ras and was persecuted by the Catholic Church for his philosophy. So what interested me particularly about this book was that St. Teresa of Avila, being a Roman Catholic nun, espoused Roman Catholic dogma. Do you understand what I mean by dogma? She wasn't espousing Gaudiya Vaishnav dogma. Of course, there were many times where she would say things like, God is so much more than we explain in the Catholic Church. You know, the philosophy we have doesn't really begin to explain everything, and so forth and so on. And she would describe things that were far beyond the normal Catholic teachings. But it struck me, how is it that somebody, I mean, she was following the four regulative principles. She belonged to an order of nuns that was vegetarian. Of course, she was celibate. They didn't take any intoxication, and they certainly didn't gamble. But it really struck me that how is it that someone's attaining Madhurya Ras, Madhurya Prem, with a different dogma? Interesting, isn't it? I really started meditating on, you know, do we really have to fight over specifics and dogma? Is that actually necessary? Do we have to consider that if somebody has some small disagreement about dogma, that necessarily means they're going to hell? Anyway, so some interesting thoughts. So when we say that some of the followers of Advaita Acharya deviated, they really deviated. And it was a very serious deviation. They were denying the personality of Godhead. It wasn't the kind of deviation that we fight about. And to be able to distinguish what deviation is an upper sampradaya and what difference of opinion is really due to the fact that we're different people and we have different takes on the absolute truth as a person really requires a great deal of maturity and a great deal of realization. It's not something that can be done by someone who's a Kanista Adhikari. Kanista Adhikaris think, however I think is the truth, and God is, and I own God, and I can tie up God in my temple. So this is something that I see our movement really needs to develop, persons who are truly brahminical and independently thoughtful, and persons who can say, hey, that's an upasampradaya. That doesn't have the same fruit. That's going in another direction. That's offensive. And, that's still on the tree. It may be a different branch, but it's still on the tree. We think about, and this is so difficult to tell, we think about Swarup Damodar, who is Mahaprabhu's secretary, and the literatures that Mahaprabhu would read would first have to go through Swarup Damodar. And there was at least two times that I can think of that the devotees in general said, oh, Mahaprabhu, this is a great book. And Swarup Damodar said, no, it's not. It's full of philosophical deviations. It's full of rasabasa. So to really have that discrimination, at the very least, it's good if we have some humility and not jump to the conclusion that I know it's right and anyone who doesn't agree with me is an idiot and blaspheme devotees just because they don't agree with us. So that's the end of my controversial part of this class. All right, going on to Achyutananda, specific followers of Advaita Acharya. So Achyutananda has all kinds of stories of Achyutananda, but we're just going to pick this one where he went to his father and he said, how can you say that Kesha Bharati, who's the sannyas guru of Lord Chaitanya, is actually the guru of Lord Chaitanya, because Lord Chaitanya is the guru of everyone. How can he have a guru? And Advaitacharya was very happy that his son said this. So sometimes we think that Vedic society is very hierarchical in the sense that nobody can ever argue with their authorities. Sometimes we think like that. Sometimes we think it's hierarchical in the sense of being a dictatorship, where you're not allowed to ever say your authority is wrong. But here we see that Advaitacharya's son is arguing with his father and telling his father, this is not right to say Kesha Bharati is Mahaprabhu's guru. And the father's very pleased. Father doesn't become angry and say, you rascal son, how dare you disagree with me, be quiet. I mean, one of the main reasons I left the religious faith of my family was I ended up having religious leaders who said things like that. You know, I said, what is it, how is it that, you know, God gets angry at the Israelites and Moses breaks the tablet and God says, I'm going to kill all them and start over with you. And Moses says, well, you can't do that because you promised Abraham and you can't break your promise to Abraham. And God says, oh yeah, you're right. It didn't make any sense to me. I'm like, well, Moses is right and God is wrong and Moses convinces God to change his mind and what in the world? If I understood God was a person, but I was being told God is not a person. So I couldn't make any sense out of it. And I went, you know, to the religious leaders and please explain this to me. And they said, be quiet. You're not supposed to ask this question. So I said, goodbye. I was studying in the theological seminary. Anyway, I said, bye. I said, you know, if you're going to yell at me for asking a question and telling me I'm not allowed to ask that question, then I'm out of here. So we don't find, that's not the Vedic paradigm. That's not the Vedic paradigm. We find that in Vedic culture, this is just 500 years ago, we find in Vedic culture that the authorities were very happy if their subordinates asked a challenging question respectfully, just like Maharaj Parikit. He asked Sukadeva Goswami, how can people be saved from hell? And Sukadeva Goswami says, by atonement. And Maharaj Parikit says, that's not right. And Sukadeva Goswami says, great! He doesn't say, oh, you terrible thing, it's not right. And so we should be very careful in our Hare Krishna movement that we really, you know, we talk a lot about Vedic culture. And a lot of what Vedic culture is encouraging people to ask difficult and challenging questions. To encourage people to ask questions we can't answer. To encourage people, even if they're juniors, to point out something in a senior, I disagree with that. With respect, obviously. With respect. Yeah, we should encourage that. And we should all become independently thoughtful. I love that story. Okay, Krishnamurti was another son of Advaitacharya. And Mahaprabhu was always in his heart. Wouldn't that be nice if Mahaprabhu was always in our heart? Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
Yes, so we can pray like that to Panchatattva. Please always stay in my heart. Please always stay in my heart. Please let me find my real identity as your servant so that my mind will never wander from your lotus feet. I'm so tired of, what did Devahuti say? I'm sick of the disturbance caused by my senses. So we can go to the Lord like that. I'm so sick of the disturbance caused by my mind and senses. Manashastranindriyani prakriti stani karshati. I'm so tired of this karshati with my mind and my senses. Please manifest in my heart. And we have a story of Sri Gopal. What a wonderful story. So Mahaprabhu and his associates are cleaning the Gundicha temple. So this temple is vacant all the year except when Lord Jagannath comes, so it gets very dirty. And they're really having fun. We were talking about this, yes? Were we talking about this? I was talking about it with somebody. I don't remember if it was on the Vyasa Sun in the last few days. Were they talking about it here or no?
You mentioned it.
No, okay. I mentioned it?
You mentioned
it. I did. Did I mention how they were having fun?
Yes, you did.
I did. Okay, thank you. All right, so they're cleaning, they're sweeping, and all the time, instead of saying, please give me a broom, they're just saying, Krishna, Krishna. And when the other person gives the broom, they're saying, Krishna, Krishna. Wouldn't that be fun? That would be fun, huh? So all these devotees, they're just handing each other brooms and going, Krishna, 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 Krishna. And then they're taking the water and they're throwing it on the walls and the ceiling and the floor. And it's making rivers coming out. And they're just all saying, Krishna, 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 Krishna. Right? And as part of the cleaning, they're also dancing. Right here again, we see this mood of a servant. Mahaprabhu is God. God is cleaning. You know, there are people in India, particularly in India, who have this mood that I'm a high caste, I can't clean. One of my good friends was doing some service at one of our schools in India, and she mentioned something to the teacher. She said, you know, after school, after class, you can engage the students in cleaning the classroom, and you can also help them. And then the management of the school came to her and said, you're not welcome here anymore. She said, why? She said, the teachers were very offended that you suggested they do any cleaning. They're Brahmins, they don't clean. Oh, that's interesting. So this mood, you know, I'm high class, I don't clean. And sometimes you find these Indians from these higher castes, you go to their home and the bathroom is filthy. You experience this? Oh, I can't clean the bathroom. I visited the home of one Indian family, and they had one servant to clean the house and another servant to clean the bathroom. I said, why can't your main servant clean the bathroom? Well, once she cleans the bathroom, it's finished, that's the end. I said, why can't you just clean the bathroom and then take a shower? No, once you clean the bathroom, that's finished. Lost your caste. So even the regular servants, they don't want to clean the bathroom. It's quite interesting. So, but Mahaprabhu, he's cleaning. He's cleaning with his own cloth even. Right? He's enjoying being a servant. He's relishing being a servant. So they were there in the cleaning, and they were dancing and chanting, and they were all just in ecstasy. Jai, we're cleaning. This reminds me, oh gosh, so many years ago, Hare Krishna, how many years ago? 40, 41 years ago. I remember it was some big festival, and I was in the pujari room. This is in the old Evanston temple, and we were across the hall from the kitchen, and the devotees in the kitchen were cooking for the feast, and my guide, Brother Lakshmi Narayan, was I don't know what he's doing anymore. Anyway, he was in charge of the kitchen, and everyone in the kitchen was having a big kirtan, and everyone in the pujari room was having a big kirtan, and everyone who went through the hall joined in the kirtan, and we were all doing our service and having this kirtan while we were doing our service. So they were dancing and dancing and dancing like that. Huh? And then while they were dancing, Dvaitacharya's son, Gopal, so he fainted, and he fell to the ground unconscious in the middle of the kirtan. So that Advaitacharya picked up his son and he started chanting mantras to Nisingadev. And he was chanting all different mantras to Nisingadev, but his son still remained unconscious and everybody started crying. Then Mahaprabhu came. And he said, my dear Gopal, get up and chant Hare Krishna. Get up and chant Hare Krishna. Get up and chant Hare Krishna. And then Gopal got up and all the devotees were chanting Hare Krishna. Happy ending. All right, next one. This is not one of Dvaitacharya's sons. So far we've been looking at Dvaitacharya's sons. This is one of his followers. We'll end here. I'm sorry we started late because of technological problems. But this is a really cool story. So is that all right? Is that all right? And that's cool? That's cool. Okay. So this is about Kamalakanta Vishvasa. So Kamalakanta Vishvasa was a very intimate servant of Advaitacharya. And he noticed that his master had a debt of 300 rupees, which today is nothing. But 500 years ago, 300 rupees was a considerable sum of money. So he was thinking he wanted to be a good servant. And so he wrote a letter to King Prataparudra saying, would you please help out my master Advaitacharya to pay his debt? Somehow or other, this note, instead of making it to the king, somehow or other it got into the hands of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Mahaprabhu wasn't very happy with that. So he said to Govinda, don't allow this Kamalakanta Vishvasa to come here. Now in this note, Kamalakanta Vishvasa had said, Advaitacharya is God, but he's in debt. And Mahaprabhu said, this doesn't make any sense. How can he be God and he be in debt? He said, don't let this person come here. So when Kamalakanta Vishvas heard about this, he was very unhappy. I mean, you'd be unhappy, right? If Ananta says, Ananta Prabhu says, okay, out of the temple, you can't come see the Panchatattva anymore. Get out. There's one temple I know of in a Hare Krishna movement many years ago where there was one, the temple president, that was his favorite method of dealing with any problems in the temple. He had a whole list of banned devotees. Nowadays it's kind of a badge of honor among the devotees. I was banned by that temple president. But they were very unhappy. You know, you're not allowed to come. Now, Advaitacharya was very, very happy. Now, why would Advaitacharya be happy that his servant was banned from seeing Mahaprabhu? Now, this goes back to the concept that Advaitacharya, although he's Mahaprabhu's senior, he wants to be seen as a servant. You can only punish your servants. You can't punish your superiors. I mean, nowadays you can do anything, I suppose, but, you know, in a civilized society, you only punish people who are subordinate to you. You can't give a punishment to your superiors. So Advaitacharya saw this punishment of his servant as an indication that Mahaprabhu had accepted Advaitacharya's servant as his servant. You can't punish random people either, can you? And can you just like walk down the street and walk up to somebody and say, hey, you can't do that. Even I give the example a lot. When I'm giving a class, I can say things that are heavy. Right? Why can I do that? Well, first of all, if you're sitting here in the class, that indicates your willingness to hear something heavy from me. You can always get up and walk out if you want to. And also, in a class, you can always figure I'm not talking to you. Right? If I say something really heavy, you can think, oh yeah, she's talking about the person sitting next to me. Or she's talking about the people who didn't come to the class. Right? But if I'm talking just to you, it's a different thing. So I can say something heavy in the class, but I can't go outside the class and walk up to you and say exactly the same thing. Do you understand that? Because that relationship isn't there. So if you chastise someone, that you can only chastise someone and rebuke somebody if they're in a subordinate position to you. Does that make sense to everybody? You understand? Temporarily, very temporarily, in this class, I'm taking a superior position. And tomorrow, when I'm sitting in the class, I won't have that superior position anymore. It's temporary. And when we walk out of the class, even today, I no longer have a superior position to anybody. You can only rebuke people if they're in a subordinate position. So by Mahaprabhu being able to rebuke and punish Kamalakanta Vishvasa and show that he was accepting him as a servant. So Advaitacharya said, I worked really hard in the past. I started teaching Mayavadi philosophy just so I would get rebuked by Mahaprabhu, just so he would accept me as a servant. And even Satchimanta was criticized. So you're so fortunate. So then Kamalakanta was pacified. And then, this is the really fun part of this lila. I love this. So Advaitacharya goes to Mahaprabhu and he doesn't say, what are you doing, rebuking my servant? But instead he says to him, you've done such a great favor to Kamalakanta Vishvasa. What offense have I committed that you don't show me this favor? What offense have I committed that you're not chastising me? Just see that he's relishing this mood of a servant. So Mahaprabhu was just laughing. He was very happy. Basically, Mahaprabhu was defeated by Advaitacharya. Advaitacharya reinterpreted the whole situation. Instead of understanding that banishing Kamalakanta Vishvas was something bad, he reinterpreted it as something very good. So then Mahaprabhu laughed. He was no longer angry at him, and he asked Kamalakanta to come back. And then Advaitacharya said, now you've cheated me twice. First you punish him in a way you won't punish me, and then you invite him back to be one of your intimate associates. And Lord Chaitanya was very happy. Such sweetness! Why do we you want to stay in this dry material world where there's no sweetness? There's such sweetness in this relationship between the Lord and his devotees, between two different Vishnu tattvas. Hare Krishna is so sweet. Now, Mahaprabhu's not quite done here. Right? And this is a little heavy part. So it's late and we've already gone over time. So if you want to leave now, that's fine. I won't be offended because this is a little heavy. All right? Or if you want to stay because you think you have to stay to be polite, you can play on your phone or something if you don't want to hear this. I'm just warning you. So then Lord Chaitanya said to Kamalakanta, first thing that he said is, why are you calling God a beggar? You can't say that Advaitacharya is God and at the same time say that he's in debt. But then the other point that he made is, why are you asking money from King Pratyaparudra? You cannot ask money from King Pratyaparudra. He said, Advaitacharya is my guru. And yet you're having a guru beg money from a materialistic person. He says, if we take money or grains from a materialistic person, our mind becomes polluted. Now, you have those notices up there from the beginning of ISKCON where Prabhupada says we should not eat food cooked by materialistic persons. But we're finding more and more in our Hare Krishna movement that, we do. Even I'm seeing in temples, you know, even I go to temples. Even I've been in a temple for the Sunday feast. Even I've been in a temple for Lord Nityananda's feast where they're serving bread from an ordinary bakery. And I've learned that I have to ask now. Even if I'm in a temple with installed Radha Krishna deities, I have to ask, where is this from? Who made it? And I have to risk offending everybody. Somehow we don't get it. I mean, and I've been to ISKCON sponsored program. Recently, I probably made some people very upset. They were doing this whole program where I was the main speaker and we was, you know, it was advertised as a program with me. And then we're there at the program and they pulled out all this bread that was obviously from a shop. And I just said, oh, well, where is this from? Oh, we bought it from a shop. And I said, would you please put it away? You know, one of the women said, well, I work, you know, is it all right if I buy it in my house? I said, you know, you do whatever you want in your house. And she said, oh, that's okay. I said, no, it's not that it's okay. You know, do whatever, but not that you do it in ISKCON's name. I said, at least don't do it in my name. So my father ran a food company. My father was the CEO of a big food company, big international food company. I used to go to the factories when I was a little kid. And please believe me, the mentality of the people in those factories is really bad. And he ran a religious food company. Everyone in that company had to be certified as being religious, and even the food there was all offered in their Jewish way. It wasn't offered the way we offered it, but they would take some of the dough and they would throw it in the fire as an offering to God and to the sages. And still, the people who worked there, the mentality was really not very nice. They were just working there for money. And before I joined the movement, I was a professional baker in a hotel. I used to bake the cakes and the pies and the muffins. And the people who worked there, they were all full of envy. They were all like, when am I going to become the hotel manager? When am I going to become the hotel manager? I was the only person there who didn't want to become a hotel manager. And when we eat food, we're also eating the consciousness of the cook. I was in a temple once where devotees fought a lot, even sometimes physically. And one of the main cooks was a very violent man. A very, very violent man. I mean, really violent, like really, really, really violent. He would take out knives and threaten people with knives in the kitchen. We had to call the police on him. And we'd go to the temple authorities and say, can we please get this guy out of here? And he says, no, he does valuable service by cooking. But I'll tell you, the whole temple was a very contentious temple just from eating this person's cooking. And, you know, for some empirical evidence, which you can take or not as you like, there's this kind of photography called Kirlin photography where they can photograph the aura of things. Again, you know, if you want to take that as evidence or not as you like, it's not Shastra. But they photograph food, and they find that when food is cooked by somebody with love for the family, it has a bright aura. And when you buy food from the shop, it has practically no aura. They find even if an angry person touches food, the aura of that food decreases. So when we're not, it's not just that our physical body is ingesting physical food, but our subtle body is also ingesting the consciousness of the cooks. I mean, ultimately, it'd be nice if we grew our own food and, you know, everything, every step done by devotees. And we can ask about money. This is also really difficult to understand. How do we say that we shouldn't accept money from materialistic people? You know, I told last night about how this person who worked at a casino gave me some money, and I just put it in the DVD box. I didn't want to touch it. So, of course, we're collecting so much money for our Hare Krishna movement from materialistic people. But it is a fact that if on an individual basis, if as a Brahmin and as a preacher, if you're being maintained by materialistic people, we're going to become compromised. And for so many years, I didn't understand why Raghunath Das Goswami stopped accepting his father's money. It just didn't make any sense to me. It's like he's using the money to worship Lord Chaitanya. Why does he stop taking it? And then for a while, I was in a temple where the bulk of the money for the temple came from one very wealthy person. And then I understood. The devotees were all being maintained by this person, and they stopped doing their service nicely. It didn't matter. They got money in the mail from this guy. The deity worship went down. All the food in the shop became full of mold. The service in the restaurant went down. Then nobody cared anymore because some rich person was maintaining them. And, you know, the person can also change the standard. I thought, oh, this is why it's very dangerous if you're living as a brahmana, as a preacher, to be maintained by materialistic persons. It can compromise one's principles, it can make one's lazy. As Mahaprabhu was saying, your mind becomes polluted. So why should we care that our mind becomes polluted? Because then we can't think of Krishna. So if we're really struggling to think of Krishna, we were talking before that a struggle to think of Krishna can be that we have the wrong identity. But also a struggle to think of Krishna can mean that our mind is polluted. Now we're not talking about a person who has a job out in the world and gets a salary. We're not talking about that. Although in some cases we could be. And then Mahaprabhu says, especially those who are acting as spiritual masters, especially those who are acting as teachers of Dharma. By the way, when Mahaprabhu is talking about spiritual masters here, he's not just talking about the people on the approved, authorized list of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He's talking about anybody who's a teacher of Dharma. So it's not that we should think, I don't think anybody here is on the approved, authorized list. But it's not that we should think, well, this doesn't apply to me because I'm not really a guru. If we're teaching about Krishna, then we are a guru. At least that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says in Madhya Lila 8.128. So we should be very, very careful that if we're teachers of Dharma, that we're not compromised. All right, just a quick summary. That Dvaitacharya is the cause of creation, a teacher of bhakti who called for the Lord, who propagates the moon as of a servant, and we looked at his followers, Achyutananda, Krishna Mishra, Sri Gopal, and Kamalakanta Vishwasa. And this was Adi 6 and also Adi 12. Thank you for your patience with our technological glitches and then our way over time. And I'm very appreciative that you were willing to stay this long. I hope there was something valuable. Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you so much for this beautiful presentation. And I'm curious what this janitor company did to mutilate their employees.
Oh, I can send you a link to the book. But what they did was they took a survey of the employees. The president, it's a short book and it's just a story, it's our reading. The president of the company said, well, the reason that the employees aren't motivated, they had a 400% turnover rate per year, which was costing them a huge amount of money. And the president said, well, they're leaving because they don't have enough money. We're not paying them enough. You know, it's all money. And the vice president says, well, how do we know it's money? Maybe they have a different grievance. And the president's like, oh, that's ridiculous. And the vice president fought and fought and fought to have a survey of the employees. Finally, they agreed, anonymous survey. They found out that the main problem was not money, it was transportation. Because most people couldn't afford to have their own car, and they were often cleaning businesses at night when the buses and the trains weren't running. And it was, you know, dangerous neighborhoods where they couldn't walk. So then the company started providing shuttle vans. And they cut their turnover rate down to about half just by doing that. Just by providing the vans. And then after some time, the vice president thought, well, maybe another problem is that people don't have any way to advance, which is what I was talking about. That it's a dead-end job. You know, you're cleaning toilets, you don't feel that you can go anywhere. And my doctoral thesis was on the job satisfaction of teachers in the Hare Krishna movement that I basically surveyed. I was able to survey 90% of the people in the movement in the fall of 2005 who were teaching in primary and secondary schools. And what I discovered was that what motivates the devotees is, which surprised me, exactly what motivates everybody else. So the things that motivate people are recognition, responsibility, the work itself, and advancement. So they said the problem is these people find no room for advancement. They can't progress. And they thought, well, how do we give them any room for advancement? The nature of the job just isn't like that. There isn't room for advancement. You know, just isn't like that. And they said, well, maybe we can help them to advance in general in their lives. Maybe we can help them progress in their lives as a person. And he came up with this principle that the purpose of any organization is to become the best form of itself. And in order to do that, each member of the organization needs to become the best form of themselves. So what they did was they had another anonymous survey of the employees, and they asked them, what are your dreams? What do you want to do in life? What do you want to be? It was interesting. Most of them had simple dreams, like I want to own my own house, or I want to take a vacation to Miami, or something like that. And so then what they did was they hired someone to be what they called a dream manager. And he was someone who was able to help people. He had a lot of experience in financial management, different fields, and they'd make connections. And they helped people to achieve their dreams. And as they helped people to achieve their dreams, the people became loyal employees of the company. And not only that, they started, and not everybody enrolled in the program at first, but as they saw that people were, you know, they were buying their house, they were going on vacation to Paris, they were, you know, learning, some of them didn't know English, some of them only knew Spanish, so they were learning English and so many things. And then the employees started saying, can my children meet with the dream manager? Can my grandchildren meet with the dream manager? And pretty soon, they got down to zero turnover rate in the company. Nobody was leaving that company. Then the vice president said, well, that's not good. Some people probably ought to be leaving the company. So then they started employing someone to help people who were ready to move on, move on. I think they got down to like a 10% turnover rate. People who were ready to go on to another occupation or people who just didn't fit. And pretty soon so many people were applying to work in this company, they couldn't even handle all of the... They could start to be very selective about who they hired because they had this long waiting list of people who wanted to work for the company. And pretty soon the employees started asking not for more money but for more work. The employees were going to the bosses and saying, you know, we can finish cleaning at, you know, such and such company early enough that we can really clean at another company before we clock out for the night. They started using less cleaning materials. They started becoming more efficient in their use of the company products. And the employees started going to businesses and saying, you know, why don't you hire our company to clean? The employees started becoming sales reps for the company. And at first, you know, they had to spend money. Eventually, they had 11 dream managers. They had to spend money hiring these people, but their profits, you know, like quadrupled. And then other companies went to their leaders and said, why don't you come work for us? And they wouldn't, nobody would leave the company. You know, everybody wanted to work there. And, you know, when I was reading, I was actually crying when I was reading it. It was very moving. And then I'm studying about Maharaj Prithu. And I was reading how Maharaj Prithu fulfilled all the desires of all the citizens. I was thinking, you know, if we were to do this in ISKCON, I really doubt that most devotees would say, my dream is I want to, like, take a vacation in Paris. Or I want to buy a house. I mean, some people would say, I want to buy a house in Mayapur. I'm sure that's the dream of some devotees. But I think most of our devotees, our dream is, you know, I want to open a restaurant, right? Or I want to just maintain myself by book distribution. That's the dreams of the devotees, right? I want to write a book. I want to get my Bhakti Shastri degree. Isn't that the dream? I mean, some devotees are going to say, I want to marry a beautiful devotee girl. I mean, that's, we're going to have a little bit of that. But even that, I think it'd be nice to facilitate. I don't know about the beautiful part, but, you know, it'd be nice to facilitate that. And I thought, if we really did that for our devotees, if we really facilitated that each devotee were to realize their dreams in Krishna consciousness, then I think it's a fact that if an organization helps each member to become the best version of themselves, then the organization naturally becomes the best version of itself. And so many times I see that we try to hammer loyalty. You know, you've got to be loyal. If you're not loyal, you're not going to go back to Godhead, and you're not going to serve Prabhupada, and this kind of stuff, which after a while gets sort of like, leave me alone. So, but real loyalty, you're actually loyal, and you give your best when you're getting your needs met. This is just simple. Whether the organization is ISKCON as a whole, whether the organization is one temple, whether the organization is one project, you know, if people are getting their needs met, then they're going to give everything, just the way it is. And that's, of course, how Krishna operates. And it was a very short book. It was interesting because most books on management, they just talk about principles and then they give a story as an illustration here and there. And, you know, by the time I got to the end of, like, chapter 3, I thought, okay, now they're going to end this story and they're going to go to another story. It was just this one story. And at the end, he talks about how you can institute this in your organization. How you can help with your organization, and even if you're an individual, how you can help people to achieve their dreams. And they're very practical. You know, if somebody says, I want to buy a house, they work with them and they say, okay, how much money would you have to save up, and how would you organize this, and how would you organize that? And they'd connect you with other resources, and here's somebody who's selling a house at a low price in a nice neighborhood. They would make these sort of connections for you. And, you know, I don't see why we couldn't do that. That if some devotee said, well, I really want to get my Bhakti Vaibhava degree. I mean, that's one of my dreams, is to get my Bhakti Vaibhava degree. I don't know how I'm ever going to do it. But it'd be nice if I could meet with someone who said, okay, this is how you could organize your life, and this is how you could do that, so you could achieve that. Does that make sense? You know, usually we're kind of on our own, and we think our dreams are impossible, and we're never going to achieve them, or we don't really have anybody to help us. And I had, maybe I shouldn't say this, because I'm going to do it here, but I'm going to do a seminar here about Srila Prabhupada in our lives and assisting in his mission. So one of the things that I do in that seminar is I and this started in the Gurukula with my students. I did it every year on Prabhupada's disappearance day. Why? Because we never had school on Prabhupada's Vyas Puja day, because everybody was up till 2 in the morning the night before. So on Prabhupada's disappearance day, I would ask all the students to write an offering to Srila Prabhupada. But I wouldn't ask them to write one of those Jai Jai offerings. You know, I mean, I like the Jai Jai offerings. But I asked them to write an offering of service. I guess I'm a little skeptical about some of the Jai Jai offerings, because some of them, do you only see them on Vyas Puja Day? Do you have that? The people who only show up on Vyas Puja Day, and then they go Jai Jai, and then you never see them again the rest of the year. So I asked them to make an offering of service. You know, what service would I like to do for Srila Prabhupada? And I said, no limits. You can imagine you have unlimited money, unlimited talent, unlimited anything. What offering would you like to make? And they would write cool things, like some of them, you know, I'd like to have a deity of Lord Chaitanya made out of gold and decorated with diamonds, and some of them I'd like to, you know, open a chain of restaurants all over the world. And every year I would write my offering also. You know, I want to have a school system, and anyway, Hare Krishna. So I did this in Auckland, New Zealand, on Prabhupada's disappearance day. We had probably 150, 250 people. It was a packed, very large temple room, packed with people. And I had them pass out paper and pencil. And then I said, okay, we have 10 minutes. Everybody write your offering of what you'd like to offer to Srila Prabhupada, and then to take the paper and put it on the Vyasa Sun. I'm not sure how many people. It was more than 10. Somewhere between 10 and 20 people came up to me afterwards. And a number of them said things like, no one ever asked me before how I would like to contribute to the mission. I went, oh my God. You know, the people were just saying to them, do this, do this, do this, do this. And you know, everyone who came up to me said, this is one of the most enlivening things that I've ever done. And what I would tell people is that, first of all, Krishna accepts things offered on the subtle platform. So even if it doesn't happen on the gross platform, it doesn't matter, because like that Brahmin who offered the sweet rice. And the other thing is, if Krishna approves, then who knows, it may happen on the ghost platform. Krishna's pretty amazing. So that's my experience with that, and that's, you know, that's really just a drop in the bucket as for what could be done. Anyway, I'm happy to give you the name of that book. It's a short book. Okay, we should probably go to prasadam now. Thank you very much. Adwaita Charya ki jai, Krishna Das Kaviraj ki jai, Chaitanya Charitamrita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The beginning.